You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products, with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM, serving Philadelphia and New Jersey, as well as Northern Delaware. And you can listen from anywhere in the USA or anywhere in the world simply by going to the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Live link. Also, you will be able to hear a rebroadcast of today's show on the internet around 2 o'clock by going to the Listen Anytime link, and you'll receive an email update if you are on our e-list. And if you'd like to be on the e-list, go to the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com, and you will find the e-list right above the symbol of the Made in America store. Do fill it out, and we'll make sure that you get an update each and every Wednesday morning. And, of course, after the show, you'll receive a rebroadcast. And thank you all for spreading the word. Now, if you would like to do something special for your family and friends, get them involved in the Buy American Made campaign, especially during this special time of year, as people are going out to shop and talk to store managers, and the hustle and bustle is a good time to bring attention to what we are talking about. Our faithful panel members are Mark Andel, the founder of the Made in America store. And remember, you can go to madeinamericastore.com and you'll find all of the products that are featured there at the Made in America store. And by the way, they are 100% made in America. And Larkin Connolly is our small business advocate and SCORE mentor. And he always has a lot of good ideas. And Larkin, I want to tell you that everyone gets a lot of positive publicity wherever I go. This weekend, we have a big celebration on Saturday at the museum. And then on Sunday, I have 400 people in the Manny Young section that I'll be greeting. And it's going to be a nice time for us to share the newspapers and all of the ideas that people have. So I'll be looking forward to seeing our people up there at the Paha in Manny Young. Also, Rich Logis, principal of RJL Technology Integration, who has always got the ideas and the rants, and oh man, is he unbelievable. And Rich, also, you get a lot of compliments from the people. Our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky. I'm Michael Blihash, and I'm always pleased to hear from you, because what you tell me most often, I also repeat in some of my commentaries, and would like to take this opportunity to say thank you to the 20 radio broadcasters that repeat my weekend radio commentary during their public service time. It is a very important way for us to be with the people. And during the last few months, we've had the great pleasure of having as our special guest Curtis Ellis, who you know as the executive director of the American Jobs Alliance and a well-known journalist. He's worked on, man, oh man, lots of political campaigns, and also served as a senior policy advisor to President Trump. I'm always getting compliments from people who see Curtis Ellis's articles in various publications and on the internet. Curtis, you are a very big plus, and we're happy to have you as our special guest, and hope that we'll be able to unite everyone more than ever with the idea to focus on America, American workers, America's businesses, and America's future. Now, there's been, just to go off a little bit, there's been so much of a waste of time in the major news media trying to convince all of us how bad one person is over the other. But there's still very little time directed to positive issues like businesses operating in America that need you very badly, especially at this time of year. People tell me they are tired of hearing from the national media. The national media should be educating Americans about the importance of jobs in America and the stability a job provides for employees, families, friends, communities. It allows you to run your household without stress. And today we're also hearing a tremendous amount about the tax overhaul. So we have a lot to say. And I'm going to start off today with Mark Andel, mainly because he is the gentleman who can tell us what he thinks, before we get to anybody else, about the corporate tax cut. Mark Andel.
Yeah, how you doing, Mike? And the whole crew's on. Welcome, and our listeners. Mike, again, we're in the heyday right now, our big holiday season, and Made in America Matters. I just came from a bus. The bus came from Chi-Lai, New York, by Rochester, and we don't get a lot of buses in December, but these were all women that just get it. You know, you got to love them because they understand, they love America, they know the work ethic, and they just really, I joke that women lead and they do, but these women were fired up, Mike, and I just left the bus to come over. Yeah, you know, this is our run, Made in America Matters. The tax advantage, we do a lot. Again, I'm in this game. I've got 84 employees with General Welding and Made in America. We live and breathe it daily, and entrepreneurs, it's a tough sport. You know, everybody I help start in business or give ideas, I tell them stay hungry and never quit. Rich knows, listening. You know, it's a tough game to make a dollar. And any chance or hope we can get with a tax relief, if it's a corporate tax going for 35 or 39 to 2025. Unbelievable difference. If you make money, then it matters. And we, you know, getting out of survival mode and getting the country healthy and positive, where the confidence level is up and buying's up and building's up, and we're giving business owners confidence to spend money in their own country and give them any extra money you can buy equipment with, you can hire more. And again, I'm all about livelihoods. I'm challenged about that all the time. They'll say a mega corporate tax is different than a corporate tax. No, it's corporate tax. So if you're Mark Andel, if you're GM, you're paying a corporate tax. And it's just very important, Mike. Any cuts, and a lot of people just don't do their homework. They don't get educated. They don't know the facts. And the media will throw it at a different. They spin it where it looks bad. And, Mike, we see it all the time. But exciting times with tax relief. There's a lot in our tax laws now, and if you know it and use it, you're very smart to do that, because the more you can, number one, you got to stay in business. You got to keep your cash flow alive, which is your blood flow of a business, and you've got to stay positive, and you got to grow. You grow or die in business, because customers die, customers move on, people change. You got to be always adjusting. It's a moving floor. So anything on the tax code that can help us, and I do believe it's helping us, if you lower taxes, it puts more money in the business owner's hand, and generally they're going to do good things with it. They're going to invest.
And you know, you're right, Mark, because if the people I'm talking to, they said if the corporate tax is reduced, we will self-impose ideas to invest in America.
Absolutely.
Employ in America. It'll benefit the people, the businesses, not keep us where we are today. And I'm really, really glad to hear from the people. I'll be hearing from probably 600 people over the weekend. And I am glad that we're going to be able to speak about these kinds of things in the future and give people ideas. That, you know, Mark, every year at this time, we come up with a theme about for our broadcast for the coming year. I'd like to ask all of you, Larkin, Mark, Curtis, Henry, every person listening, every businessman, to promote the idea of showing the American-made label more prominently than ever before. As I go around, Mark, many of those corporations that are proudly posting the Made in America label, they can certainly expand their product lines, bring in more employees, and bring that tax down to zero by reinvesting in America where we really need it. And with that, I'm going to ask Curtis Ellis to join in and let me know what you think.
Pleasure to be here. Well, I am very confident that the Senate and House conferees are going to get this tax bill done. They're going to get it reconciled. They're going to figure out the best way forward so that businesses get a tax cut, middle-class Americans get a tax cut. We put more money into the economy, both on the business side and on the consumer side. There's a lot of moving parts here. We see there's a lot of incentives there to invest and to build and to hire, and that's what we need. There may not be everything in there we want, but look, this is the beginning. This is we're getting rid of, cutting through a lot of the underbrush, getting rid of a lot of the complexity, and simplifying so that people will not have to go to H&R Block and hire accountants to do their taxes. Businesses are not going to have a platoon of CPAs on staff in order to take advantage of the tax code. And overall, it's been a good thing, and it's going to get done. So there are a couple other issues out there on the table that I'll be happy to talk about. But on the, you asked me about the taxes, and I'm confident that this will give a shot in the arm to capital spending in America and to hiring. And that's what President Trump promised on the campaign trail as candidate Trump, to make America great again, get America working again, put more money in people's pockets, and put more steel into our skyscrapers, into our bridges, into our roads, and rebuild this country.
Absolutely, Curtis. I couldn't agree more. And as far as the accountants and all are concerned, they will be able to get more clients as new businesses open. They'll go from doing income taxes or in certain months of the year to being employed 12 months of the year. And I think that everybody will benefit. I can see everybody benefiting. And the main thing is the focus is now on America. How do we make America the best place to do business? That's the whole thing. Larkin Conley, I know you're ready to join in.
Good morning, Michael, Mark, Rich, Henry, and Curtis. Good morning. I agree completely with Curtis, and for the life of me, don't understand how the opposition keeps on calling this a bill that's going to make the rich richer. When you cut Mark's taxes, corporate taxes, from 35 to 20, I think we're making Mark rich is what I think we're doing. And it's not that he doesn't deserve every penny of it, but for the life of me, I heard Nancy Pelosi yesterday call it a death tax. I mean, it was an amazing press conference that she had. I wanted to bring up another subject, though. You know, as I move through the week, I see these things that kind of amaze me. Here in Jacksonville, Florida, where I reside, we had an event earlier this week, 2 days ago, where a judge sentenced a 24-year Congresswoman, Corrine Brown, to 5 years in prison for embezzling money out of a charity fund that one of her staffers started to help young kids get to college. They embezzled, I don't even remember the numbers, I'll allow you all to go read them, but it was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And she got convicted of tax fraud along with that. The entire time this was occurring, she said that she didn't do this, that she trusted her staff and they let her down, and here she is going to jail for 5 years. The staffer that created the funds getting a year and a half because he cooperated, and the direct staffer who wrote a lot of the checks got 4 years instead of the probably 10 that she should have gotten for being actually the embezzler. Here's what cracked me up about the whole thing. No, it didn't crack me up. It kind of disappointed me. It was the fact that her constituency stood up and said, why would we convict somebody who has been a public servant and has done so much good for our community? To which I wanted to respond, but I wasn't there. They paid her $170,000 a year plus $1 million worth of expenses to do that job. Why would I give her applause? The exact reason that I'm so annoyed with everybody in Congress because they don't do their job and still collect the 174 or whatever the famous 500 make is the part that I find most egregious. So, Ms. Brown, please don't plead that you're a champion of the public because you got paid an awful lot of money in 24 years to be that champion.
I agree.
The fact that you had the steel and you were convicted by a jury of your peers that you had to steal that kind of money just, it, to me, is the epitome of what's going on in Congress and on the Hill.
Well, this is part of the problem that has never been seen in the past. We're seeing a lot of things that we've never seen in the past come to light. And that in this case, the media should have been following these kinds of things years ago rather than trying to discourage one person over the other to think that America's dying and that we're not part of the global economy and all. We have a new cheerleader in town. We have to cheer with all of them, with him and all of the people trying to make a change in the great USA. We really need it. I want to see people have money so that they can use it for their own health care, home repair, save, do whatever they want, do something special with their family, not just be worried about tax, tax, tax. And with that tax issue, and by the way, the person who has yelled and screamed for probably 5 years now about corporate taxes, bring the money back home, is none other than Rich Loges. Rich, you have to be Michael. Complimented because you have been the endless beating drum.
Show me the money. We love black people. No, I didn't say that part of it, Kurt. I mean, sure, we love black people. We love everybody on. I just like Jerry Maguire. You know, Tim, don't censor this. You don't have to push the button. It's okay. I'm not. It's, you know, I mean it when I say it. I'm just saying, Michael. Good morning to you. Good morning to everyone. Show us the money. And you know, Curtis, here's the thing about this. You know, any tax bill, we look at it. We like parts. We don't like parts of it. I generally feel like, as a rule of thumb, people, politicians, shouldn't generally get everything that they want. So here's the thing about the bill that I'm sitting here scratching my head thinking, what's the harm in it? Because I know a couple of things for sure. I know that small businesses, working families, the Henry Chaplinskys, the Mark Andels, the Curtises, Larkin, your children, everyone's going to have more. Everyone got a pay raise the other day. A pay raise, Curtis. And the same people against that pay raise always seem to only pay the minimum amount of taxes that they need to pay. Isn't that funny? Do you know anyone, Curtis? Do you know anyone who's ever said, this was a good year? I think I'll write the Treasury an extra 10% of what I owe. I want someone to introduce to me that person, Michael. Who is it? Maybe that's the same person. Maybe that's the same person who will finally achieve what I've been also saying on this show, which is to find me a Democrat-run city in America that I can afford, and I don't need a bazooka to walk around to feel safely in. Maybe that's the same person. Because here's the
Rich, I think you should contact Nancy Pelosi and ask her to be the first to write the check.
Nancy Pelosi doesn't even know who the name of the president is. How many times has she said George Bush in the last year, Curtis? Every other press conference, she says George Bush. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. It's okay to not like the guy, but, you know, get his name right at least. And Larkin, you mentioned former Congresswoman Brown, who was up in Jacksonville. She was a congresswoman. How long? You guys want to know how long she was a congresswoman for? 24 years. 24. So I'm going to do some math really quick. 365 times 24 is 8,760 days. 8,000. Let's round it up because I failed arithmetic in school. So let's round it up to 9,000. 9,000 days. And after 9,000 days of being in Congress, which before that, she was in state government, Larkin, for 4,000 days. And at the end of it all, the exit, the encore, was a felony. And what did most of the people around her say? Oh, we need to support her. And it's why I say to you guys all the time, people laugh and they think I'm nutty. If Jeffrey Dahmer ran as a Democrat, the Democrats would support him and say, Curtis, I know he's a cannibalistic serial killer, but he's a pro-choice cannibalistic serial killer.
I would say he was probably hungry. You know, people deserve to eat.
I know he has a right to eat like everybody else. Yesterday, sorry, I'm bouncing around here because
what are you complaining about? He could have been on food stamps. Why are you complaining?
You want to talk about Curtis? You want to talk about bringing stuff imports over the border? You guys got to try some of this embargoed Cuban coffee over here, man. This stuff is like, woof. I mean, it's something else. Yesterday. All small business owners, Michael, need to – it's already done. The arguments are over. But everyone needs to pay attention to this Masterpiece Cake Shop baker, this case in Colorado, because that case is going to have ramifications for small businesses if the Supreme Court rules against the baker. And for those who aren't familiar with the case, they need to get familiar with it. 2012, a baker exercised his religious liberty freedoms and said, I don't want to make a cake for a gay wedding. That's what he said. Me personally, I don't really agree with what he did, but it's possible. I know this is hard for a lot of Dems to understand. It's actually possible to disagree with the speech, but to still support the right to it. If he loses this case, I do think it will have negative repercussions. And you know where the guy Curtis really went wrong? He should have said he was an atheist. If he'd said he was an atheist, he'd have had all the godless, statist, secular Dems and D-Mike, Democrat media industrial complex scurrying to his side, calling him an intrepid American hero, exercising his rights against tyranny. But instead, he didn't do that. He just said, you know, I don't want to make the cake. You could buy anything else in my store. If this guy doesn't win, it rolls the red carpet out for this kind of litigation against small businesses. So that tax cut, Michael, that we're getting, we might need to spend it on lawyer fees if this thing goes out.
Oh, my gosh. My God.
Curtis.
Yes. You know, I was watching the coverage of the Masterpiece Theater, the Masterpiece Bake Shop, being argued before the Supreme Court yesterday. And there was a detail that came out which – the fake media, the fake news, never reported before, which really casts it in a different light or a sharper light. This fella said, look, I'll sell you any cake in the store for your wedding. That's fine. Go have fun. Enjoy it. Enjoy the cake. What I will not do is I will not decorate the cake, right? Because this guy's like, he's a master cake decorator as well. And he does pictures, and they wanted him to paint a rainbow and unicorns and gosh knows what. And he said, as a creative artist and a painter, I can't do that. It's against my beliefs. It'd be like asking – he didn't say this, but it'd be like asking the rabbi to do Happy Birthday Hitler on the cake, you know, or something like that. Or, you know, Nazis are great. I love Nazis. I can't do that. It's against my religious beliefs. I cannot do the rainbow wedding cake you want. I'm happy to sell you a cake, but I just won't decorate it. I will not write on it, I love your marriage, okay? I just can't do that. It's against my belief, which I think is a very interesting discrimination, a very interesting discernment, or a very interesting difference. It's not like he's saying, get out of my shop, I hate you, I will not do business with you. He's saying, I can do this, but I can't do that much. And so we'll see how this comes down. It's a very interesting fine point, which I'd never heard in all the months leading up to this and all the back and forth on it. No one's ever never made that distinction. That's the word I was looking for. It's a very interesting distinction. I will sell you a cake. I'm happy to sell you a wedding cake, but I will not decorate it with my artistic pastry art, because that I just can't do that.
Well, see, Curtis, so, I never heard that before.
Exactly.
This is the first time I'm hearing it.
It's like I don't feel that I can be compelled to write something and draw something I don't want to draw or write, which is very interesting. I mean, I think that's the fine point of the case, which the whole thing is going to turn on. And I have a hard time, even though I have no problem with gay marriage and this or that, I have a hard time saying, well, you have to, you are compelled to write something or draw something that you don't want to. But I'll leave it to the Supreme Court justices to do that. There's two other topics that we've talked about over the last weeks that there's some new developments in that I'd like to bring up. One of them is on these renewable fuel standard and the refineries down there in Philadelphia area that are being hammered by the EPA regulations requiring them to buy these ethanol paper credits to prove that they're blending ethanol into their into the fuels they refine. Well, this week, Senator Ted Cruz is meeting with President Trump to talk about this. He wants to get this resolved. Right now, you have, as I said, the small refineries, the independent refineries. We're not talking about Exxon and the big boys. They're fine. They're taken care of. They have no problem with the system the way it works now. But it's these small independent refiners where you've got hundreds of high-skilled workers down there in Delaware and down there in Philadelphia elsewhere across. Pardon me?
Marcus Hook.
Yep, Marcus Hook, that are getting that their jobs are at stake here because of this really Byzantine system that the EPA has created. So Ted Cruz says, look, there's a way that we can keep the ethanol producers happy and the refinery workers employed, and we can allow the export of American-made ethanol to count towards the government quotas of how much ethanol has to be made, how many biofuels, how many gallons of biofuel have to be produced in this country. Let's count ethanol exports toward that goal, and let's not have the small independent refiner be the ones that bear the burden of the whole ethanol biofuel program on their own. So that's one good development, and we'll see what happens. Look, the guy in charge of the Judiciary Committee happens to be Chuck Grassley, Senator Grassley. He's from Iowa. He's a big ethanol guy. He's saying, look, the system works for me right now the way it is. Let's not change it. It ain't broke. Don't fix it. Ted Cruz is saying it is broken. Let's fix it. But he's found a way to make sure that nobody gets hurt so that the corn farmers won't get hurt, the ethanol producers won't get hurt, and the on our side, the refinery workers won't get hurt either. And it's very interesting to see Ted Cruz, the most conservative of the conservative Republicans from a right-to-work state, he's going to bat for the unionized workers in Pennsylvania who work in these refineries. So politics makes strange bedfellows, and that's a very good development. We'll see what comes out of it. As head of the Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley is very important to President Trump's future because the Judiciary Committee has oversight on the FBI, on Bob Mueller, on all those crazy investigations going on. They're investigating nothing. You know what? We ought to call Bob Mueller Ghostbuster. This is the Ghostbusters investigation. They're investigating things that don't exist. You know, they're looking for ghosts of collusion. You know, the Russian ghost of Christmas past or something. I don't know. It's crazy, but I don't want to get off on that tangent. The other story that I wanted to update everybody on is the general system of preferences, which is the tariffs that we put in place. In 1974, we decided we'd help these underdeveloped countries develop by letting them sell their products in America tariff-free. We eliminated tariffs on thousands of products imported from underdeveloped countries so they could build up their middle class, build up their industries, build up their capitalist system there, and you know, not become commies, right? That was basically the idea back in 1974. It turns out the prime beneficiary of this program is India. As I mentioned last week, we had the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in India. Well, India's been able to sell thousands of its products here, everything from manhole covers to jewelry, tariff-free, and the program is known as the Generalized System of Preferences. What they were supposed to do, though, is those countries were supposed to give us an even break when we wanted to sell goods into their markets, and they're also supposed to respect U.S. intellectual property rights, not pirate our goods, not, you know, we're going to let you sell goods in our country, but please don't sell cheap counterfeit knockoffs of American goods, okay? That's the deal here. I don't think that's asking too much. India has benefited tremendously from this program, but unfortunately, India has not lived up to its end of the bargain. And make no mistake, I love India. I love Indian food. I love the Indian people. I've traveled to India. It's an amazing country, amazing culture. But they really need to play by the rules. When we try to sell stuff into India, we get the shaft. Harley Davidson has 100% tax on its bikes sold in India.
I couldn't believe that. Yeah, well.
Unbelievable.
100%.
Their knockoff pharmaceutical industry, that's one of the major industries in India, is cheap generic knockoffs of American drugs. And they put price controls on their healthcare market. So if we're selling medical devices in India, they are not only face tariffs on the way in. Once they get there, there are price controls, so they have to be sold at such low prices that our companies are losing money. So what does India do? Then the government puts in another law that says, well, you can't shut down and leave. So you're forced to sell at below market prices and lose money. It's a very interesting idea of a free market economy there. And a lot of American agricultural goods face either outright exclusion or high tariffs. So, you know, all in all, it's kind of a rigged game. Not kind of a rigged game. It's a definitely rigged game. And they are constantly stealing U.S. intellectual property. So it's what's going on now is that the general system of preferences is up for renewal. And we're saying that India should its benefits should expire. They're set to expire at the end of 2017, and unless they take positive steps to fix their behavior, we should let their benefits expire because they're just not doing what they're supposed to. They're not living up to their end of the bargain. And this is another example of how the United States government does not behave like any business. If you had a contract, as a businessman, had a contract, and the counterparty to your agreement did not live up to their end of the contract would be null and void. You would not waste any time in getting out of that deal. Tell me if I'm wrong, but that's the way it is. Now, when I was working in the International Affairs Division of the Department of Labor there in the Trump administration, there was another case of Guatemala. We're not living up to their end of the bargain in one of these trade agreements. I said, well, how about we just get out of the agreement? And they said, no, we can't do that. I said, well, what kind of contract is this? We enter into a contract, and if the other person on the other end of the contract violates the terms of the contract, doesn't that make the contract null and void? So, no, it doesn't work that way. Well, so what's our recourse? Oh, well, they're not living up to their end of the contract, so we're supposed to give them money to help them live up to it. I said, you're kidding me. That is the deal? That we entered into this trade deal with Guatemala, and they were violating all of the terms of the agreement. They were shooting their workers. They were killing people. They were making them work like slaves so they could sell stuff into the U.S. cheaper than we could possibly produce it here. But the agreement says they're not allowed to do that. That's right. Okay, so that means the agreement should be null and void, and we ought to just scrap the whole thing and say, bye-bye, you're on your own now. No. The agreement says that if we prove that they're actually doing that, then we will give them money to help them correct their deficiencies in living up to the agreement. So we're giving them an incentive to not live up to the agreement. We're saying we're going to pay you if you don't live up to the – I mean, these are the kind of cockeyed schemes that the U.S. government enters into all the time. And this deal with India is another example of that. For years, for decades, they have been violating the terms of the general system of preferences. They have been excluding American products from and American businesses from access to the Indian market while we've been giving India preferential treatment and access to our market. And We know they've been cheating. We know they haven't been living up to their agreement. And now it becomes it's going to become a big debate in Congress as to whether or not we should let India's preferences expire. There should be no debate at all.
By the way, how long has this been in effect with India?
Since 1974.
Okay, well, I think it's time to have all of these ideas sunset. I'd like to see all the trade agreements on the table. I'd like to see all the senators, Grassley and everybody, Cruz and everybody else, say we want all of this publicly shown to the people, what's been going on, and would the American people of today, right now, agree with that?
Yeah, look, it was a different world in 1974. We were fighting the Russian commies. We were fighting the Chinese commies. We were fighting the Viet Cong. We were fighting everywhere. America was this huge... everybody here was happy, had a job. Well, not everybody, but you know what I mean. It was a much more prosperous society in 1974. A lot of the world was still, some of it was still crawling out of the wreckage of World War II. But it's a different world now, and it's time to reevaluate all of this stuff.
You're right, and I'd love to see, once this tax deal is decided, one way or the other, that they start on the trade agreements, because everybody talks to me about trade agreements. They want to know what is in there that makes America's stuff so expensive to send overseas, and all the stuff from foreign countries so cheap to bring here. Cheap is not always the answer.
That's right. It is not.
If you mark up a Harley 100%, Curtis, yeah, you're never selling one in India, correct? It's a $15,000 bike to a $30,000.
Pardon me?
I mean, that 100% on a Harley just shows you how much percentage they're making it. The perceived value is just they're not going to buy a Harley-Davidson in India.
No.
If you mark it up 100%.
Yeah, I'd like to see, Curtis, if you can get your ear to the right person. I mean, let them hear what you have to say, because this cannot continue. I would like to see all the trade deals on the table. Let all of us, look, every American person, have the opportunity to read what was agreed to, how it's benefiting us, and how it may be able to help all America to get down our tax obligations with our businesses to zero by expanding their businesses, new product lines, more employees, more advertising to get the product on the market. It's got to be changed. We're in a time of change. Let's not stop it.
And Curtis, who benefited from these shady trade deals, would you say? Who actually... Because they put them together, we put them together, whoever. I mean, just the countries, but somebody had to have their hands in it, right?
Sure. The global corporations that really, they were looking for the cheapest labor on earth. See, this is something, it struck me last night. We, you and I, everybody on this panel, we understand we live in a country. We live in a country called the United States of America. But the top executives of the Fortune 50, the top corporate entities on earth, they view themselves as working in the global economy. They don't look at the world as countries. They don't see themselves as citizens of the United States. They see themselves as global operators. And so they're looking for the cheapest labor on earth. They're looking for the cheapest tax treatment on earth. They're looking for the cheapest deal on everything, whether it's raw materials, taxes, or labor, the cheapest inputs. And then they're going to move those assets around and sell at the highest price. They want to buy low and sell high. And they don't want to be restricted by countries. So if they can move a factory from Pennsylvania and move it to China, where the government of China will give them subsidized energy, give them free land, build a factory for them, in order to capture that capital investment for the long term, the government of China will do it, and these countries and these companies will play along. They go along with it. They're looking at the short term, whereas the government of China is looking long term. And I said, this is the key difference. As individuals, as people, you and I think of living in a country, living. We're thinking long term. We want a place to live, to settle, to raise a family, to raise kids, raise grandkids, generations, generations, generations. As corporate executives, they're looking at quarterly profits, and they're not thinking in terms of the human aspect of living and settling and having a family. They're thinking of how can I maximize profits for right now, for the next quarter, maximize the stock share, the share price for the next, you know, fiscal year or something. And so that's who benefits. They benefit, the lobbyists benefit, they pay the politicians, so the politicians benefit by getting donations to the campaign war chest. Ask yourself, how did Nancy Pelosi come to be worth $20 million or, you know, however, and she's worth many, many, many tens of millions of dollars. How did she do that on a salary of $175,000 a year?
And the speed that they do that is incredible, the time frames that they get these millions and millions. Yeah, that's a great answer, Curtis. I thank you.
Very well said. I like that. Yeah, that's a very good question. How did she gain that wealth on $170,000 a year salary?
You don't have to stop at Nancy Pelosi.
No, not at all.
The dean, and it's on both sides of the aisle. It's,
absolutely.
It's endemic of the institution. I mean, you're talking about Conyers, who had to borrow $200 to buy a suit to be sworn in to Congress 30 years ago, 28, whatever it is, it's egregious, at 88 years old, said that the recent things that have occurred to me will not taint my my reputation in the Senate. Well, Mr. Congressman, I beg to differ with you just a little bit, but he's worth how many millions of dollars from being a congressman? Seriously. It's egregious.
Seriously. I ran a campaign a few years ago against Spencer Bacchus. Spencer Bacchus since retired. He was head of the, I believe, Ways and Means Committee, one of the powerful financial services committees in the House of Representatives, a fellow from Birmingham, Alabama. And he was discredited because he was doing all these stock trades on the side. And he was a Republican. This was exposed by Peter Schweitzer in a book that he wrote. And Peter Schweitzer is a conservative Republican who's been attacking the Clintons, brought the whole Uranium One deal to light. But he's an equal opportunity offender, and he pointed out, has Spencer Bacchus traded on inside information he got as being a member of Congress? Right before the financial crash came down, all the leading committee chairmen in Congress were briefed about this before it was made public that there's going to be the Lehman Brothers, whatever, the Treasury Department's not going to bail out Wall Street or something, bail out this one trading firm. Spencer Bacchus, and this could have a huge effect on the market, Spencer Bacchus went and placed a trade and sold America short. He bet short on stock. He made a fortune betting against America using inside information. This happens all the time. I mean, this is what George Washington Plunkett, famous corrupt New York congressman, called honest graft. He says, if I know the city's going to buy up some land for a park, I'm going to go in there beforehand and buy that land first before the law passes so I can sell it to the city. You know, this perfectly honest thing to do.
You know, Curtis, I wanted to bring this to your attention and ask you for your opinion on this. On the debt clock, it lists that there are 95 million Americans not in the workforce. How would you explain that?
Well, you have, it's tragic. You have people that have given up looking for work and been unemployed for over a year. After they're unemployed for over a year, they're not even counted in most statistics, in most the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They're not counted as out of work. It's funny. It's the way they jigger the numbers. You have people that, and then after you're out of work for a while, you maybe lose the skills, and it's harder to find a job. It's harder to get a job.
because you're not up on the latest version of Windows or, you know, Microsoft Excel or whatever, or the latest technique for doing this or that. So it becomes more difficult. The other thing, which is happening more and more, and we've talked about this before, is people who are unemployed for a long time become discouraged. They lose hope. Maybe there are no jobs around to have them, and they go on disability as a way to support themselves and their family. And now you've got the, in addition, you've got this horrible opioid epidemic of drugs and alcohol. People who are out of work, this has been correlated. Many has been shown to be more than correlation, but it's been shown study after study for decades. As the unemployment rate increases, so does alcoholism, drug abuse, child abuse, domestic abuse. If you can't support your family, it's a cause of stress. Divorce rates go up. It's not rocket science to figure this out. It's tragic. And look, a lot of jobs have been shipped overseas. Let's be blunt about this. Things that used to be made in America are not made here anymore because somebody's profiting by it, profiting by using the cheaper labor. I'm sorry, folks, but the truth of the matter is, for hundreds of years, we had tariffs. European labor, it used to be in the 1890s, the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, European labor was cheap labor. They had developed their industries. They had the mass production and the economy of scale for industrial goods that we did not have here in the United States. And the southern states, the slave states, the plantation owners wanted to buy the cheaper manufactured goods from Great Britain. But the northern state, Abraham Lincoln, the Republican Party, said, no, we are going to erect a wall of tariffs to keep out the cheap slave labor, the cheap labor goods made in Europe, and we're going to promote our own industries and raise the wages and raise the businesses and industries in America. That's how America was built. Not a pretty picture of free trade, kumbaya, get rid of borders, we're the global economy, and everybody gets along. No. We said, rather than making American workers compete against the cheap foreign labor, we're going to raise the prices if need be, but we're going to make sure people get paid well in this country. And at the end of the day, we will have a steel industry, we'll have our own money, and we'll have our own steel industry. I mean, Abe Lincoln said this about the Transcontinental Railroad. He built the railroad across the country, and he said, but the rails have to be made in America. That way, at the end of the day, we'll have a railroad, and we'll have a steel industry, and we'll have the money. And that's exactly the playbook that Japan used to rise out of the ashes after World War II, Korea used to rise out of the ashes after the Korean War, and that China used to build up its industries and become the economic superpower it is today. They are using the playbook that the United States used in the 1800s and that Great Britain used in the 1600s to become a major industrial power. It is not secret sauce here.
You know, there are times when I hear all of these pragmatic issues brought up about killing trade agreements and presenting them to the American people and like starting from scratch. And I really think that's one of the issues that we have right now is if you were to kill every trade agreement we had and splay it out on a table and ask the Americans, what do you want to do? You'd get 18% of America to answer the question. We're not engaged. We're not engaged in our own futures. We're not engaged in what's gonna fix things.
You're right, Larkin.
All we are is critical. All we are mm-hmm. is this is wrong, that's wrong, but what's the fix? Well, I don't know. Well, maybe you ought to elect somebody that feels the same way you do. Okay, I'll do that, but make sure it's not raining on election day because mm-hmm. I don't go out in the rain. So that's one of my big problems, that if we really want to fix things, fix the American family. I've said it forever. And get America engaged in our future. Get them to understand that, you know, you can't just get up and go to work and come home and play with the kids, help them with their homework, put them to bed and go back to bed and go to bed and sleep. I mean, I know we can get caught in ruts. I was caught in one for 30-some years. But we also have to be engaged in our future, and that's the problem. We are here. But beyond this radio program, you know, it's a great turnout to elect Trump. And what was the percentage of people that came out and voted? It was amazingly low.
Not enough.
It was amazingly.
It was 70%. It was 70% of the people came out.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I wish there was a way for us to get 100% of the registered voters. That way we really know what's on the minds and in the hearts of the American people.
Well, you know, we could do the old purple finger. If you're walking down the street the next day after the election and your index finger isn't purple, they throw you in the clank. Well, I don't know where they do that, but it's one of the Middle Eastern countries.
It might be a nice idea if we could give a special break, a tax break, $100 break or something. I understand in some countries, if you don't vote, you do pay a little bit of a tax.
Australia has a mandatory voting. And I tell you what, if Philadelphia passed mandatory voting, you would see the entire state of Pennsylvania have to adopt mandatory voting in order to make up, you know, because Philadelphia is so overwhelmingly Democrat that then the other party would make sure, well, let's make this happen in the whole state, right? So
I'm not sure, but if you started paying people to vote, you'd probably have to cut the money that they're paying right now for people to vote two and three times.
I think the Democrats do that, pay people to vote. It's called food stamps, right? Vote for us, right. We'll give you more food stamps.
Rich, you're sitting there quiet, and I know you have something to say.
I want to ask Curtis something. And sorry if I spoke over you, because sometimes the line's a little delayed. And I'm going to ask you something, Curtis, and it's not a gotcha question, because when NAFTA went into place, next month is 24 years since NAFTA went into place. It was bipartisan. It was started with President H.W. Bush, then President Clinton. President Clinton had Republican support. Let's say, for argument's sake, the intentions were genuine. Let's just say for argument, we'll give the benefit of the doubt for a moment. The intentions were genuine. Okay. I want to ask you something. Did NAFTA, remember when it was sold, NAFTA is going to bring all this abundance and prosperity to Mexico, right? It was.
Oh yeah.
It's going to be back to the era of the Aztecs. Everything's going to be amazing. Did NAFTA save Kate Steinle? Did it save her?
No. NAFTA is a huge failure on both sides of the border. There's a study that came out this last week or two. Wages have been stagnating in Mexico. It's been a disaster for Mexico. Mexico has lagged behind wage growth of other underdeveloped countries since NAFTA in the last 25 years. NAFTA has lived up to none of its promises. It was supposed to stop illegal immigration because everybody's going to make a lot of money working in Mexico. So they won't have to come to the United States anymore. That didn't happen. And it's actually destroyed businesses in Mexico as they were facing competition from imports elsewhere. It destroyed the farming sector in Mexico because the big grain traders like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill were able to finally export taxpayer-subsidized corn grown in Iowa. They were able to sell it tariff-free into Mexico. What did that do for the Mexican farmer? Destroyed him, wiped him out. He was no longer able to raise a crop, sell it, you know, to the tortilla maker. No, the tortilla maker was now buying corn grown in Iowa. What did all those farmers do, those Mexican farmers that used to, you know, poke a stick in the ground, plant some corn, make a living, raise their kids? They went to San Francisco and shot Kate Steinle, you know? I mean, they came north because they were wiped out.
So then let's say, Curtis, the intentions were true and genuine. But all that matters in the real world, you know, this place that we all we all dwell in, all of us here, where stuff's not free. All that really matters in the real world is the end result. That's all that matters. So the end result to me sounds like not only is it an economic issue for American workers, families, and small businesses, it also sounds to me like it's a national security issue. Are you guys aware? Have you seen anywhere in the DMIC, Democrat Media Industrial Complex, any journalists, quote-unquote, ask Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, or Paul Ryan if NAFTA has contributed to national security issues, to opioid issues? Because I wonder, Curtis, if our borders hadn't been so porous and had someone who was deported on five occasions and had seven convictions here in American courts, if that person had only been, if that person hadn't re-entered the country on the sixth occasion, Kate Steinle would be alive right now.
That's right.
She'd be alive. So we have enough American criminals. Do we really need to import the rest of the world's criminals?
Along with everything else we import,
do we really need to import criminals?
Ladies and gentlemen, as you can hear by the music in the background, this hour has been an hour of power. I'm going to ask you to be the power behind all that we are trying to do by going out, shopping at your local stores. Make sure, whether you're going to the hoagie shop, the pizza store, you're buying flowers, make sure you let people know that you're a supporter of the Buy American Made campaign. I want to say thank you to Rich Logis, Larkin Connolly, Mark Andel, our guest, Curtis Ellis, our engineer, Henry Chaplinsky, and I'm Michael Blihash. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks to all of our sponsors. We acknowledge them 6 days a week, and we thank them for allowing us to have this hour of power to share good news and good ideas with you.
Michael, yes. Real quick, for everyone listening, Curtis, thank you. Thanks, guys. Next week, we're going to have, as a first of two interview segments, we're going to have the son of the late, great Justice Scalia, Chris Scalia, on air with us for an interview.
And we'll be able to listen what he has to say and also make some comments about what he's offering to us. Well, guys, thank you so much for being with us. Curtis, hope to see you be with us next week. Please keep our message moving with all of your contacts, because America needs all of us working as one people for the betterment of one great nation, America. Thank you all for tuning in. Kindly spread the word. You'll get a copy of today's broadcast in the email a little later on, but you can tune in anytime by going to AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
Have a great week, guys. We got a snowstorm coming in Buffalo.